This podcast is produced by the Rec Peer Education Team. The Rec Room is the youth programs branch of Kachemak Bay Family Planning Clinic. To learn more, visit homerrecroom.org.
Hello, and welcome back to Alaska Teen Query. I'm your host, Esme Golden. Today we are talking with Val Shepherd about LGBTQIA healthcare. Go ahead and introduce yourself, Val.
I'm Val Shepherd. I go by she and they pronouns. I've lived here in Homer my whole life, or at least for the lion's share of it. I've been very active in the arts community. I'm just very committed to seeing growth while I'm here. Certainly more recently, just the LGBTQ plus population, specifically of this town.
Our first question is, what do you think are the biggest healthcare barriers for LGBTQ people today?
There's any barriers that are really prominent when it comes to LGBTQ plus healthcare. It all boils down to empathy in a lot of ways and understanding. The standards of care for trans people specifically are very outdated because they're based around what's called WPATH, which is this sort of checklist that a lot of providers have to kind of almost require you to hit these bullet points before they allow you to either get started on hormones or pursue surgery of any kind. It's, like I said, it's all very outdated, and it's been gradually updated, but very, very slowly. And in many ways, too, LGBTQ healthcare is tied in with this as well, because a lot of people will assume certain things and will also kind of jump to conclusions based off of somebody's gender identity or their sexual orientation and assume that that might have something to do with it. It's what's known as trans broken arm syndrome. What the idea boils down to is that you walk into a doctor's office and you say, I have a broken arm. And they're like, okay, well, what's your assigned gender at birth? And it's like, well, what does that have to do with anything? Like, I don't know, my assigned gender at birth is this. Oh, but that's not incongruous with your, you know, current gender identity. But if you consider that maybe that has something to do with your broken arm, and it's like, I broke my arm by, like, you know, tripping and falling down my stairs, and just that could happen to anyone. It's not specific to, you know, my gender identity. But that ties into a lot of trans-related healthcare, is that people will assume that maybe it's because you're on hormones that, you know, something is different, or because maybe your mental state might be different now, or maybe it's due to depression, and there's all these extraneous factors or external factors that, while they may be tied into a trans identity, they aren't necessarily like the symptoms of like the source of discomfort or pain. But it seems like many doctors just sort of jump to the conclusion that they are, mm-hmm. and that can be very frustrating. So yeah, I would say that having doctors that, even if they're not trans themselves, are at the very least understanding, have, you know, worked with trans patients and understand healthcare as it is currently evolving and aren't just stuck in these ways, these old ways that are exclusionary and also rigidly binary.
What are some ways that healthcare facilities are making it easier for people facing these challenges?
As far as easier goes, it's I would say that there are things that healthcare facilities have been doing, accommodating people's pronouns better, their chosen name, and not insisting on referring to them by either their dead name or the pronouns that they want to distance themselves from. But again, all of that is sort of contingent on just the hospital that you happen to be attending or, you know, seeking care at, because hospitals are also just wildly diverse, especially in this country where there's a lot of sort of individuality and the, you know, the freedom of choice that, you know, these providers can have. When you find some, you know, hospital or a provider or a healthcare plan or system that works, it's like you cling to that and you don't want to lose it, and because to lose that means that you're going then heading headfirst into so much uncertainty and doubt, and you don't know if you're going to be able to maintain the same standard of care. A lot of states, and Alaska is one of them, have started including trans healthcare into their Medicaid plans, and certain states have then also chosen to include gender-affirming care into those plans, and I myself have been able to cover my hormones under Medicaid, which has been an incredible boon because I went from about, I want to say, $200 a month that I was paying out of pocket to about $7 a month. It's kind of touch and go, and you pretty much just got to hope for the best and hope that if you find something that works, that you can hold on to it as long as you can.
Do you think it's important for clinics to ask about pronouns?
Yes, I do think it's important for people to ask and to affirm, because especially in situations like being in the hospital, seeking care, those are very vulnerable moments. And especially if they happen to be related to gender-affirming care, they're very significant and impactful moments. And having those moments undercut by people who just willfully disregard someone's identity or pronouns when that is literally the reason for them being here is demeaning. And in many ways, like for some people, that's the point, is that they're being intentionally demeaning because they know how much it hurts and they know they want this person to know how much they disapprove, but doing it in a way that is not like malicious. And I say that with massive air quotes, because it's more in like the litigious sense of the word, like they couldn't get taken to court over it, especially if these are somebody's, like, still, if this is still their, like, their legal name and pronouns. It's just like, well, I'm just calling you by your name. Yeah, be it, like, emergent care or elective care that you're seeking, it's still, it's a very personal experience, a very impactful experience, and it's also one that is just, you know, it can cause a lot of anxiety, especially in certain people. And so, yes, just having somebody there to be affirming, to be, you know, to help you through these things without undercutting your identity, and it just feels like a common courtesy that can go a long ways. And even if people don't think that they're being hurtful, they very much are and can be.
What do you think are some of the biggest differences in LGBTQ healthcare as opposed to cishet healthcare?
Well, I kind of touched on that earlier with the whole, like, trans broken arm syndrome. But a lot of it is not being taken seriously. They think, like, oh, somebody's looking to get something. They're looking to game the system. But with how misogynist the healthcare system can be sometimes, especially when it comes to trans women, like, trans women and trans femmes do not get taken seriously by a lot of doctors and a lot of medical establishments. So it can be that there's, like, sometimes a lot of things where it's like, I'm having this issue, and it's like, well, you can't be having this issue because you're a man, right? And it's like, well, no, but I am. And it's like, yeah, you're probably just, you're either faking it or you're misreading it as something else. And I've seen so many stories of people who check themselves in for serious, you know, like having serious symptoms and conditions, and were then just sort of pushed out the door with, like, either a prescription for what essentially amounts to just like a painkiller or an antacid or some kind of treatment that is not at all what this person needs. And then they come back later with more symptoms and they're prescribed something different that, again, is not what they need, until then it finally becomes unavoidable and it's like, oh, that's what that was. Well, why didn't you tell us? And it's like, I was telling you, like, the symptoms, and you didn't bother to, like look at them and consider what that could have been. And it's not that I personally have seen this happen, but I have heard numerous stories of this happening, and I've seen various accounts of this happening, not just with trans people, but with women, just cis women in general. They go in and they're not taken seriously because the doctor doesn't think that they're healthy, or that they may be out of shape, or they're just not getting enough sleep, or they just, you know, like, oh, you just have a headache, here's some, you know, acetaminophen or ibuprofen or something. And then when the symptoms finally become unavoidable and it becomes clear that there's something very wrong, then this woman goes back in and it turns out, oh, you have endometriosis. And, well, I hope you didn't want to have children because you're not going to now. And it's like, well, could this have been avoided? And it's like, yeah, if you told us what was happening. And it's like, well, I did tell you what was happening, and why didn't you listen to me? And I think that ties into the point I was sort of making at the beginning of this too, which is that transphobia, but more specifically transmisogyny, you know, at the end of the day, it's just misogyny. And it just is tied into this whole thought process where it's like, women tend to not be taken as seriously. A lot of, you know, and a lot of transphobic people, when it comes down to that as well, is that they don't see transmasculine people as being men or as being masculine. They just see them as like a different version of woman. So misogyny is just, it permeates throughout a lot of these systems.
Do you think it's important to talk about LGBTQ healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And again, tying back around to sort of what I was saying is that the more we learn about LGBTQ people and LGBTQ healthcare, just the more we're going to understand it, the more all of us are going to understand it. Not just LGBTQ people, but people in general will understand how to accommodate for somebody's gender identity, for just who they are, if they're going through hormone replacement therapy or if they've had surgeries or just anything, because it almost seems like common sense that, yes, of course, we want to learn as much as we can. Again, so much of it is based off of these cis-hetero models of what healthcare is supposed to be, without taking into account the fact that things can be very wildly different depending on, you know, just depending on the person, regardless of their sexuality or their gender identity.
What are some ways that allies can help improve LGBTQ healthcare or learn about LGBTQ experiences?
The biggest, I would say, I'm coming at this from a very exclusively, you know, trans perspective. I would say that as far as allies go, if there's one golden rule that I could think of, it's ask questions, but don't go overboard with the questions at the same time. Because there's nothing wrong with wanting to find out things. There's nothing wrong with not understanding something and then wanting to get an answer, and especially if you know somebody personally that is trans or is gay or is queer. Those are ultimately the people who will understand what that experience is like. But also, everyone's perspective is different, and you can ask, you know, 100 trans people and 100 gay people, you know, like what their experiences being trans or being gay are. And they're going to give you different stories and experiences because everyone comes from different backgrounds. Everyone has a different, you know, social upbringing, access to certain things, support groups, healthcare. So learning from those people is important, but also there's so many people to learn from. So leaning on like one person in general to ask these questions can sometimes be a bit tiring, because I've had to answer a ton of questions about what it's like to be trans, what my opinions on this, that, and the other thing are, and while I'm happy to answer those questions, I do get very frustrated when the same questions keep coming up over and over and over again. And it's not to say that I have, again, any problem with, like, dispelling myths or educating certain people on, like, why this stereotype is wrong or why this is outdated or why you might be just a little misled here or there. Yeah, it gets a little bit old, you know, answering the same questions, but the one bit that really starts to get to me after a while is when the same person keeps asking me the same questions or keeps making, like, the same mistakes. And I'm like, how many times am I going to have to freaking, like, remind you why this isn't okay or why you're wrong here or this or why this upsets me? And the big one, too, and this is also just something, again, more specific to trans people, but like something allies that I think really, really need to understand is it may seem like kind of simple and insignificant, but honoring someone's pronouns is so vitally important. And it, at the core, it's somebody's identity. It's who somebody is, it's who they're trying to embrace within themselves. Having somebody slip up and refer to you by, you know, the pronouns that you're distancing yourself from or from your dead name can really just kind of sting. It's like a barb. Now, and in a lot of cases, that's just unavoidable, especially at first. And while it still hurts to, if somebody refers to you by that, if it's the first time it happens, and again, this is just my perspective, I tend to not let it get to me too much. I tend to just be like, well, you know, it happens. Especially if it's somebody who's known me for a long time and just can't, you know, it's having a hard time distancing their old image that they have of me to who I am now. But when it keeps happening, and I have to keep reminding them that, like, hi, those aren't my pronouns, it really starts to feel like they aren't listening or they aren't doing the work. Specifically with trans people, honoring somebody's name and pronouns, and just, again, a simple acknowledgement of, oh, that's, I'm sorry, I did not mean to do that. When you mess up, because it happens. Messing up happens. Mm-hmm. And just to wrap this up, too, is that what I think some cis people don't really realize is that if you make the effort for one person to learn their name and pronouns to the point that it becomes second nature, that it's like, oh, that's Val, and she uses she and they pronouns, then it then becomes much easier for the next person that you meet who is just like, oh, this is their new name and these are their new pronouns. And it just sort of has like a domino effect and like an exponential sort of quickness to it, or it's just like you just learn how to normalize somebody's new name and pronouns. Because for me personally, when I first started entering into trans spaces, there were some people who entered into those spaces under their dead names and old pronouns. And it could be hard for me sometimes then when they assumed a new name to then just normalize that. Or even if somebody just changed their name that they were going by, it could, you know, be a little difficult to then go by a different name. But the more I normalized doing that, the easier it became. And end of that that little spiel right there.
Is there anything else you'd like to say before we end?
I guess if there's just any thoughts that I have, it's that one of the reasons why distancing from the binary when it comes to just gender identity is so important is because, like, the gender identity spectrum is just so massive. It's not this rigid male-female type situation, because once I normalized the idea of being non-binary, I started to have so much more make sense to me, and I started to realize that I didn't have to go strictly in one direction. I could go primarily in one direction, but I could also veer off a ways, off of a, you know, onto a less beaten path, and I would find people there that were more or less in my sort of same situation that could be like, oh, you too are experiencing like this sort of flavor of the gender. And so the visibility of recently in like the past decade or so has been absolutely just massive and monumental. But on the flip side of all of this, though, there is just this rising tide and growing undercurrent of, I mean, what is fascism? And just these regressive ideals and beliefs and rhetoric that's getting tossed around that is very reminiscent of the homophobia scares in like the late 70s and into the 80s, which then, you know, then got rolled into the AIDS crisis, and then just all the way through the 90s and into the 2000s, this was still like, you know, a battle that was getting fought. Ever since the Stonewall riots in 1969, there has been just this constant battle for gay acceptance. And gay people have made tremendous strides in distancing themselves from this this rhetoric and these stereotypes of them being groomers or of them being degenerates or abominations or whatever terms those people want to use to describe them with. And now there has been just more acceptance for gay rights, for gay marriage, for gay adoption. And it feels really kind of like trans people are in that same boat now, where they're the ones being labeled degenerates or groomers or abominations, and that they are sort of on the chopping block now. I want to have faith that people care, and they care enough to actually do something, and do something tangible that matters, that isn't performative, and isn't just sharing like a hashtag on social media or changing the, you know, the filter on their profile picture, but actually has a tangible impact on not just the people in their lives, but the people that they'll never meet.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for thinking of me. I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you, Val Shepherd, for joining us and sharing your thoughts and experiences on the topic of LGBTQ healthcare. If today's topic was of interest to you and you'd like to learn more, check out the Rec Room's official website at homerrecroom.org. Thank you for listening.